This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us is a writer for the New York Times, Wajahat Ali. If I'm pronouncing that right, sir?
That was very impressive. You deserve a Kit Kat for saying it properly.
Okay, thank you. And the website is Wajahat Ali, Wajahatali. Excuse me, that's the Twitter handle, at Wajahat Ali. And, of course, you can read his article, which is just absolutely brilliant. It's titled The Roots of the Christchurch Massacre over at the New York Times. It was published last Friday, I believe. Wajahat, welcome. First of all, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us today. I caught a little bit of you on TV this morning and thought, this guy really has clarified in his mind and through his work and research exactly what's going on here. From Christchurch, New Zealand to the United States. Can you give us a summary of your understanding of what's actually going on?
Sure, and thanks for having me on your show. It's a globalized ideology of hate, which anchors these disparate white power and white nationalist movements. The ideology is white supremacy. The ideology states that white people, or white civilization, whatever that means, is inherently superior to all other inferior civilizations and individuals and have to remain on top. One of their main fears, Tom, is something called the Great Replacement Theory. And if you're paying attention, that was the name of the manifesto written by the man who killed 50 people in New Zealand, the domestic terrorist. They called it the Great Replacement. Right. Another word for the Great Replacement is white genocide. What this says is that there's a global conspiracy headed by, quote-unquote, the Jews, who are the head and brains of the cabal. And what they're trying to do is use their wealth and money to bring in foreigners, invaders, immigrants, black people, Muslims, to overtake and weaken the white man so that the white man will be subordinated. Now, if you're paying attention and read the manifesto of the domestic terrorist in New Zealand, he said he wanted to punish the invaders, he used the word several times, and take revenge against who? The Muslims. If that is familiar to you, it's because in October, Robert Bowers walked into a synagogue in Pittsburgh, Tree of Life, and shot and killed 11 people. He said that he wanted to punish the invaders, those individuals helping bring in refugees, and he was going to get them before they got us. Specifically, on a right-wing social media site, Gab, he retweeted a post that said we have to punish the evil, filthy Jews for bringing in the evil, filthy Muslims. Now, how is Trump connected? Trump might not be a white supremacist, Tom, but he has no problem promoting white supremacist conspiracy theories, just like the one I mentioned. In October, midterm elections, you can't gaslight us. It just happened. He tripled down on one talking point and one talking point only. What was that?
I don't recall.
The caravan.
Oh, yeah.
The caravan. Yeah. This was when he was sitting on top of a pretty robust economy. There was job growth. But him and Fox News went all in that there is an invasion, he used the word multiple times, a caravan of rapists and criminals and Middle Eastern suspects and Mexicans that are invading America. What he also tweeted out was the George Soros conspiracy theory. George Soros is a Jewish Hungarian American billionaire that is allegedly funding the caravan. That was promoted by Republican leadership. That is a conspiracy theory that is part and parcel of the Great Replacement that emerged directly from white supremacist infrastructure and used in Europe. And if you look at the terrorist's manifesto, he refers to Donald Trump. What does he say? Trump is a renewed symbol of white pride, and he shares a common purpose. Why would a domestic terrorist who walks into a mosque and kills 50 people share a common purpose with Donald Trump? And there's way more examples, but that's just a taste.
Yeah. So, wow. Meanwhile, we've got, Andrew Breitbart saying that his big awakening, his conversion, was when he discovered cultural Marxism, which has now become a thing on the right. And it apparently tracks back to a small group of Jewish people who emigrated here from Nazi Germany in the late 1930s. Or at least, from what I've been able to determine. And then you've got the guys in Charlottesville chanting, you will not replace us, Jews will not replace us.
That's exactly it. The Jews will not replace us. There you go. It's white supremacists, KKK, and the alt-right who took their tiki torches to Charlottesville, and that's what they were chanting. Now, if you were paying attention, does that sound familiar?
Yeah.
What the New Zealand shooter was saying and the synagogue shooter was
saying? Well, and you go back to Anders Breivik, the mass murderer in Norway who killed 70-plus people, children, in fact, of children of liberals, because it was a liberal organization that sponsored the summer camp, specifically because he was, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, because he said that the liberals in Norway were in favor of bringing refugees into the country.
Yeah, and the shooter in New Zealand was inspired in part by Anders Breivik, who in 2011 left behind a 1,500-page manifesto explaining in detail why he shot and killed 69, mostly teenagers, and left a bomb in a federal building killing 77 people. He said that he wanted to punish Europe for being pro-immigrant, for being pro-diversity, and for being pro-Muslim, and he wanted to warn Europe.
Right.
Anders Breivik also, and I haven't been able to share this on media channels in the last 3 days, but hopefully I can, give me 20 seconds.
Sure.
Anders Breivik left behind that 1,500-page manifesto. He cites, Thomas, in that 1,500-page manifesto, the writings of American Islamophobes. In fact, Mark Sageman, a counterterrorism expert, said that those American Islamophobes, who I'll name in a second, can't be blamed for his actions, but Breivik and them emerged from the same ideological infrastructure. I wrote about all this in 2011 in an investigative report I did called Fear Incorporated, The Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America, trying to understand where these conspiracy theories like Sharia is a threat to America. That should sound familiar for anyone who's been paying attention to what's happening to Judge Pirro. Where did this come from, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what we traced was it went from the swamp and the right wing to the mainstream discourse, specifically through elected officials, think tanks, some funders, grassroots groups, and mainstream media personalities. So something that was fringe 10 years ago was literally uttered by Judge Pirro last week on her show on Fox News to defame Ilhan Omar as being a potential fifth column, a non, if you will, loyal American based on the fact that she's Muslim and wears hijab.
Right.
And Breivik inspired this New Zealand shooter. Breivik also inspired this Coast Guard who just a couple of weeks ago, Christopher Hassan, we forgot about it because it's Trump, so like there's a new chaos every day. But there was a domestic terrorist who was caught with stockpiling weapons, inspired by Breivik, who wanted to kill as many Muslims and people as possible, and he said he wanted to establish a white state. The question we have is, why is Donald Trump so impotent and pathetic in confronting white supremacists, but if it was a Muslim suspect, he tweets tough?
Yeah,
and that's a question. That's
he'd be going nuts on this stuff. The question for me, Ali. Yeah, okay, Waj. The question for me is, what do we do about this? I mean, we've got this simple reality of the browning of America and, frankly, Europe and the rest of the world. And you've got some white people who are, paranoid about that. You've got others, I would say the majority, who are using that as to exploit other white people, to crank up fear, basically a racialized fear. This is not anything new. I mean, Richard Nixon's war on drugs was meta to this. It was about black people. The reefer madness in the 1920s was meta to this, about Hispanics. We've seen this over and over and over. The Republicans for years used this, black people want to take your jobs, et cetera. How do we speak to these frightened white people who think that somehow there being a smaller percentage of the population of the United States represents a personal threat to them?
That's a very good question. I wrote about this in the summer. It's called How to De-Radicalize White People for the New York Review of Books. And you set it up really well, is that there's this perceived racial anxiety. That was the main, not the only, but the main motivator for Trump voters, according to every single study that's been done in the past 3 years. It's not economic anxiety, it's racial anxiety.
Right.
And it's politicians, like you said, who play upon these cultural wars and racial anxieties to pit the white people, the mainstream, against everyone else. Invasion, horde, Mexicans are rapists and criminals, Muslim ban. I mean, look, it's right in front of us. Trump's been doing it. The dog whistles are blowhorns, right, the last 3 years.
Yep.
And so what we're witnessing around the world is what I call the death rattle of white supremacy, which has transformed into a death march. I did not say white people. I said white supremacy. It's an ideology and a structural superiority that has been put in place in Europe and America since its foundation. And because there are more people of color, and also one other aspect that people never mention, and they should, women. Misogyny is critical in the white supremacist movement. They are deeply, deeply threatened by empowered women.
This is highly hierarchical and patriarchal.
Highly. And so the alt-right, for example, the way they recruit a lot of the alt-right guys are these straight white guys, and they say that the Jews are promoting narratives in Hollywood that are empowering women, and these women are emasculating you. And so what we're witnessing is this feeling of emasculation and weakness, a feeling where they're losing validation and power, which is why the white supremacy narrative is so powerful, just like the ISIS narrative. It goes to angry, dislocated men and women who feel unmoored, and they find a community, a sense of belonging, a validation in this community, which they find usually online, and it gives them a sense of purpose. And what I always like to remind people is they think they're the heroes, Tom. That's a key thing. They think they're the protagonist of a global narrative.
No, but
they
we're still diagnosing the problem. I mean, how do we speak to them?
So how we speak to them is the following. You need a top-down approach. First and foremost, you need the President of the United States of America to actually confront it as a problem and call it what it is, domestic terrorism. It's the number one act of domestic terror threat in America, according to the FBI. Attack it the way he attacks John McCain in the press. I mean that sincerely. So, top-down leadership, you have to call for what it is, domestic terrorism. B, we have laws on the book that can be enforced to go after them with teeth. Some people say we need more laws. For example, those laws that really attack terrorism are only for those entities that are foreign, such as ISIS and Al-Qaeda. So give law enforcement the teeth to prosecute it. Number three, top-down, bottom-up education. What's their ideology? How do they operate? How do they mobilize? Law enforcement needs to be educated. Judges need to be educated.
Wajahat, forgive my interrupting, but we're going to hit a break here in about 3 seconds. Can you stick around for another 10 minutes?
Yeah, and I'm sorry for talking so long.
No, I'm loving it. I'm loving it. And normally I don't, frankly, I very rarely have guests even on this program. But you're absolutely brilliant, and you're so well informed on this topic. I want to learn more. Wajahat Ali is with us. He is you can find him on Facebook. He also writes for the New York Times. His Twitter handle, WAJAHATALI. And of course, his piece at the New York Times. Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
His article for the New York Times, which should still be up, is The Roots of the Christ Church Massacre. We'll be right back. And we're back. Wajahat, we were talking about, you were going through your list. You want to continue going through
it? Sure. So education, top down, to really identify the markers.
And like build this into our schools.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because, when I talk to experts who are helping in de-radicalization, they said that a lot of these young men, people miss the signs. People miss it.
Do you know how long, though, we have been fighting this? I mean, when my wife and I were kids, and literally, when we were in high school, this was in the 1960s, and I was in Lansing, she was in East Lansing, Michigan. In my schools, we did not have any kind of education about people of color. There was nothing. In her school in East Lansing, it's a college town, they had 2 years of black studies. And she had to read all this stuff and that I grew up being largely ignorant of. And those programs that started in the 60s, I mean, they were coming out of some of the turmoil of the 60s, although, frankly, this would have been like 63 to 66, that those are all gone to a large extent, as far as I can tell. And that was just a very modest effort to acquaint, middle-class white people with the struggles of people of color in the United States, both the slavery and the Native American genocide.
Exactly, and you kind of mentioned in your last segment that I was listening to, right? These propagandas that we have, this meritocracy, that if you just pull yourself up from the bootstrap in America, like this equal country where, like, anyone can make it, like, but kind of being invisible to the hidden hand, the power structures, the privileges, the luck, right? And so when you see President Obama be the president, now you see people say, let's just, wash our hands of it. We live in a post-racial society. Racism, that's in the past. Move on. And then the rest of us are like, whoa, wait a second. Nope. If anything, it revealed the fissures, because the hate groups in America that exploded, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, are the past 10 years, post-election of Barack Hussein Obama. And you have to think about it, based on what I was talking about in the last segment. What could be more terrifying than a black man, son of a Kenyan Muslim,
ascending to the highest office in the land. What could be more triggering, Tom, to people who feel, quote-unquote, racial anxiety? Right. And so this type of education has to go both ways, an empowering education about all the narratives of Americans who got left out, that's us, people of color, including some of the signs about these men who are being radicalized online. And finally, two last things, online. Social media has a duty and responsibility because this ideological infrastructure thrives online. They recruit online, they radicalize, they do propaganda, and they do targeting. And ISIS and white power movements are always two steps ahead. Yes, they're minor in number, but they're highly organized and passionate. And so social media now has to find the needle in the haystack and shrink the haystack. We have to deplatform people. I'll give you one quick example where deplatforming actually works, guys. I just read a tweet right before I got on this phone that Milo Yiannopoulos, who was given a mainstream social media platform, remember him, 2 years ago, is now desperately willing to go have lunch or dinner with anyone if you pay him because he's $2 million in debt. Both him and Alex Jones have been deplatformed. Yeah. So social media has a role in this to play. And Donald Trump took away funding. This is the final thing I'll say. He took away funding from from white supremacist groups, former white supremacists who were de-radicalizing. So the question is, why did he take away the funds?
Hey, hang on just a second. Hang on. We'll continue the conversation. We're hitting the other end of this break, and I've got to read a 1 minute live commercial on the commercial side of our program. So in 60 seconds, I'll be back with you. Can you hang on? Okay, great. Thank you. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Wajah Hadali is with us. He's a contributing opinion writer with the New York Times. His new piece, The Roots of the Christchurch Massacre. And Wajahat, we're going to have about 3 minutes here until we have.
Yeah, I've been talking too much.
No, it's great. Until we hit this hard break at the bottom of the hour, we've been talking about how from top down the president should be condemning this. We need to educate people. Going back to the diversity studies that we had back in the 60s, frankly, things like this, and deplatforming these people, a comprehensive thing. But back to my original question: if what's really going on here at some level, and I have seen this, throughout my life, right? If what's going on is that white men are feeling like their privilege that they grew up assuming would always be there without even thinking of it in those terms, right? But if the white men are saying, wait a minute, our privilege is being taken away from us. And I saw this in the 1970s with the women's movement. I remember the University of Michigan, just down the street from us, there was this big lawsuit about reverse discrimination that just inflamed the right. And Pat Buchanan was out in Michigan, stomping all over Michigan, screaming about this. Women are taking the positions of white men. Now black people are taking the positions of white men, et cetera. That as long as white people are actually seeing their privilege be diminished, how do we speak to them about that in a way that doesn't make them crazy? How do you say, yes, your white privilege may be being diminished because we're bringing everybody else up to your level? And, that's going to mean that, some white people are not going to have quite as much privilege as they used to have, but it's the right thing. I mean, it doesn't seem like that's going to work with the Proud Boys.
It's going to be difficult.
And you got 1 minute.
You're not going to win them all. There's going to be some people who will be radicalized. They'll never evolve and change, just like those people who never evolved when schools were desegregated. But we need enough. Let me just be tongue-in-cheek. Moderate whites to step up and get their people and educate them and inform them and say exactly what you said, that this is better for all of our kids. It will create a just, equal society. Because in the absence of this, there will be nothing but warfare and division. And that's, by the way, exactly what ISIS and white supremacists want. They want to destroy us. Religion.
I agree. And I've been saying this forever, that it is not, it's not people of color who are going to save us all out of this, this horrible situation that basically white privilege and white supremacy have brought us. It's going to have to be white people because they're the ones who are holding the power right now to a large extent. Amazing.
Thank you so much, Thomas.
Yeah, Wajahat Ali, check out his piece, The Roots of the Christchurch Massacre, over at the New York Times. Thank you. Thank you, Waj. Great having you on.
Thanks.
I hope we can talk again.
Sure.
We will be back. It is 27 minutes past the hour, coming up on 28 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
You know, I shouldn't even use language like "will have to save us." I mean, that implies that there's the whole white savior story. But, you know, where the change is going to happen is here. Welcome back. Talk media for the sane among us. And let's check out our crazy alert for the day. Yeah, this is exceedingly crazy. I'm quoting Rush Limbaugh from his show last Friday. There's an ongoing theory that the shooter himself, he's talking about the New Zealand shooter, may in fact be a leftist who writes the manifesto and then goes out and performs the deed purposely to smear his political enemies, knowing he's going to get shot in the process. You know, you just can't immediately discount this. The left is this insane. They are this crazy. And then if that's exactly what the guy is trying to do, then he's hit a home run, because right there on Fox News, shooter's an admitted white nationalist who hates immigrants. Right. It's all a leftist theory, Rush. Meanwhile, this kind of propaganda actually has consequences. There was a new poll that just came out. This is apropos of our conversation with Sheriff Richard Mack in the second hour of the program. A new poll that just came out from USA Today and Suffolk University that finds that half of Americans now agree with the statement that Donald Trump is the victim of a witch hunt being run by Robert Mueller. Half of Americans. And that the support for impeaching the president last October was at 38%. It is now at 28%. His efforts are working. And then I get this in email here. Dear Fred, President Trump issued a formal veto of the Democrats' reckless resolution because he knows that the wall is the only way to defend the security and safety of all Americans. Democrats are already planning to obstruct and override the very necessary veto. We need an all-hands-on-deck to finish the wall. We sent him a list of every patriot who donated to our official wall defense fund, and it was noticed that your name is missing. He needs you on his side, Fred. The wall will only be built with your help. Please make your triple match contribution of any amount before 11:59 p.m. tonight to get on the next list of donors that we will hand him tonight. Yes, the king will be happy with you. Contribute $250, contribute $100, contribute $50, contribute $42. Where did they come up with $42? And then finally, this shocked me. And then I'm going to pick up your phone calls here. This just absolutely shocked me. I saw this over on Democratic Underground this morning. And the guy, the poster, CK4892, says, you know, I'm not just here on Democratic Underground. I also edit Wikipedia. And did you know that there was not even a category in Wikipedia on white nationalist terrorism until yesterday? He apparently created this. If you go to the Wikipedia and search white nationalist terrorism, it comes up, but it's basically just a very, very beginning thing. It's remarkable that all this time has passed and white nationalist terrorism is not even until yesterday, it was not even a thing on Wikipedia. That is mind-boggling. Adam in New Orleans, Louisiana. Hey, Adam, what's on your mind today?
Expanding on what you were just saying, according to that Anti-Defamation League, 100% correlation with extremist violence and being associated with nationalists and the neo-Nazis, I would argue, let's go after these organizations, not the guns. I appreciate your argument for why, the fact that guns kill.
Well, it's a very simple formula, Adam. The more guns there are in any particular community, the more suicides and homicides there are, and the more accidental deaths there are. It's just, you know, real simple math. But, you know, the fact that white supremacists are now using these guns, whereas, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, it was white kids in high schools who were apparently taking, anti-anxiety medications. It almost doesn't matter. I think that the gun argument and the white supremacist argument need to be disentangled from each other because, you know, white supremacists are doing a whole lot more than just shooting people.
Would you go so far as to say that using essentially propaganda and psychological warfare tactics against the American people, that should be made illegal. Because these people are living in just constant bubbles of hatred and fear, and that's why this seems to be blossoming. I don't really care which group, but that's what I would argue. Let's go back to
what you confront, Adam, when you try to do that is the First Amendment.
Yeah.
I mean, I just, you know, that's what you're going to confront. And if you look at the history of right-wing cult followers, the average German, I lived in Germany for a year, I knew some of these people. The average German believed in the Hitler cult right up to the very end. And they thought that he was going to bring 1,000 years of peace. And yeah, he was a flawed human being, but he's doing the right thing for our country and for the world. The Japanese, the same thing. They were willing to fly airplanes onto the deck of aircraft carriers on behalf of Tojo because it was the great way to die. The ISIS followers, these are all right-wing death cults, right? And every single one of these right-wing death cults had to be absolutely crushed before most of the cult members woke up from the cult that they had been taken into. And you know, I was hopeful when Sam Brownback became governor of Kansas and said, I'm going to prove that all this right-wing stuff, you know, Reaganomics, we're going to cut the social welfare system, we're going to radically cut taxes, and that's going to bring so much investment into this state, and it's going to supercharge our economy. He said, I'm going to prove that Reaganism works. And he did it, and he destroyed his own state to the point that he left with his tail between his legs. And I kept thinking, this is going to be the thing that's going to wake up red state America. You know, the fact that you have the highest levels of maternal deaths, the highest levels of infant mortality in the United States, the highest levels of lousy pay, the lowest pay levels, the highest levels of poverty, the highest levels of heart disease, cancer, all these things that are symptoms of poverty. Virtually all exist exclusively in Republican-controlled states, and most heavily in the Deep South. I kept thinking, you know, eventually these white people are going to wake up and say, you know, we've been played by the billionaires who told us that it was the black people we had to worry about. It wasn't the black people who were letting the banksters go scot-free. It wasn't the black people who deregulated the chemical companies and the banks. I thought that they would figure it out. No, they haven't. Not only have not figured it out, but they're tripling down on this.
Well, professionally, one of the things I do is solve problems. And you never solve the problems by going after effects. You have to go after the causes.
Correct.
And I think we're all wrestling with, how do we get after these causes?
Well, I think this is the conversation I was having with Wajahat Ali, is that the biggest cause right now is that white supremacy, white privilege, in fact, white male privilege specifically, is in fact crumbling right now, right around us. And it has freaked out an entire spectrum of white America from those, you know, the guy in Louisiana who's struggling with horrible poverty to the billionaire class, frankly. And you know, I don't know quite what to do about that, other than point it out. But it's like, that's, you point it out and they're going like, yeah, well, that's what we're fighting against, is the end of white privilege.
And that's, I think that's the purpose of the Fourth Estate, and that's why I contribute to you and your organization.
Okay.
So thank you so much.
Thank you, Adam. Anyway, AB in Lake Forest, Illinois. Hey, AB, what's up?
Oh, I wanted to talk about the two things real fast. The beginning of socialism happened when cavemen moved into caves together and had to help each other out. I mean, that was it. That was the society.
Sure.
And the second was, real fast, was there was a movie. It was a 007 movie where they talked about the... It was talking about the control of media making news and controlling the government.
Hmm.
There was and it mimicked the guy from Australia has a huge media empire. But socialism is nothing to be fearful. We've had it all along.
Yeah. It depends on the kind of socialism. I'm not a fan of USSR socialism or Chinese socialism. I am a big fan of Norwegian and French and German socialism and Canadian socialism. So, but yeah, I get your point, AB. And in fact, well said. Mark in Prairie du Sac, Wisconsin. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, it's just a horrible intersection now. You know, originally I had called on the whole firearms issue that back in the, you know, when I started shooting back in the 70s and hunting back in the 70s, that it was kind of looked down upon. These guys were carrying, you know, the big old, you know, military-style semi-automatics as opposed to, you know, the weapons designed just...
I had friends who were hunters, you know, in high school in the late 60s, and if anybody had gone out in the woods in Michigan with a semi-automatic rifle, they would have been ridiculed.
Yeah, there was a few of them even back then, the old Remington 760 and the Browning, you know, and the Winchester 100, which are just specifically designed for hunting, but they weren't the military. They weren't the military right. style weapons, and it's unfortunate. But now they've got the people. You know, the NRA somehow got co-opted now they sell kits to trick out your AR-15, which they're all putting in the old NATO caliber. You know, the 308 NATO caliber, you know, a heavier shell. But now they've got that all tricked out. Oh, they're going to take our guns away. You know that and you mentioned. I wonder if we need to come up with another phrase for the white privilege, as opposed to the fact, you know, that. And I understand what you're saying. You know, it used to be that the middle class guy could, you know, go to high school, get a good job in a factory, you know, have a middle class existence, have enough money to have a cottage up north, maybe on a little lake, and that is evaporated. And it's not because the minorities are taking our jobs away, are taking those jobs away. It's because
white people destroyed our unions.
Right. Well, it's because the aristocracy.
You know.
It's because the aristocracy has become an oligarchy.
Yes.
The founders were deeply concerned about. If you read, you know, some of the founding documents.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it's become not just an oligarchy. It's become a kleptocracy. It's like they're stealing everything that's not nailed down. And when they can't steal it, they borrow. You know, using our children's credit card. Mark, thank you for the call. Remarkable stuff. It's 46 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more of this conversation in just a few moments here on the Tom Hartman Program, helping you win the water cooler war. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's the true people's media. Back with your calls in just a moment. And welcome back. Chris in Portland. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind?
Hey, well, you know, originally I wanted to talk about, you know, how we have all these illegal aliens always coming in, as they say, but why are they coming in? They wouldn't be coming here if they didn't have a job, right?
Well, there's two categories.
Nobody ever wants to arrest the person who's hiring them. We have laws on the books. Nobody enforces that law. And I don't understand that part of it. And that ability to circumvent the law, you know, crime does pay if you're wealthy enough. That is the real problem here. I don't know why people aren't noticing this.
Chris, you know, yes. First of all, there's two categories of people coming from south of the border. The people that you just identified and the folks who are fleeing death and destruction, the actual refugees, people who are coming from the Central American countries that Ronald Reagan ruined. And they need to be treated very differently. And there's different systems for dealing with them. And those people are legally here because you can legally come to the United States to apply for asylum. So, you know, and that's what's going on right now. The people who are looking for economic opportunity have been, by and large, over the last 10 years, moving back to Mexico because Mexico has had a growing economy and the United States has had a shrinking economy. But that said, in response to your issue about arresting employers, prior to 1986, that's the way it was. Outside of the agricultural industry, the growers principally up and down the West Coast and across southern and west Texas, outside of that particular industry where we kind of just turned our head and looked the other way after Eisenhower's Bracero program collapsed, outside of that, basically, if an employer hired somebody who was not here with documentation, the employer did face the possibility of going to jail. And it was the unions, by the way, who were the ones who would call the government and say that the employer was doing it. And in 86, Reagan stopped enforcing that law specifically to break the unions. And in 1986, the two most heavily unionized industries in the United States, in terms of the number of people that they hired, was not the auto industry. It was meatpacking and construction. And within 10 years, those two good-paying jobs, you make a really good income working in a meatpacking plant or working construction. One of my brothers was a roofer and a union electrician. And you can make really good money. And within a decade of Reagan stopping enforcing that law, both of those industries were no longer unionized. And that's what it's all about, Chris. And no president since Reagan has been willing to flip that switch and turn that law back on. Even Donald Trump, who gives lip service to all this kind of stuff, is not willing to turn that, to put wealthy white employers in jail. He'd rather go after the brown people and blame it all on them. That's what's
right.
going on.
Well, that's my point was that, you know, it's a law. It's on the books. But
yeah.
It's the same with the laws in the finance industry. It's the same with all the laws Trump broke with his, you know, faking his tax returns and saying his property's only worth $5 million when really it's worth $50 million, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
He's been doing that. He's president. Crime does pay, and this is the problem.
It does
really
pay if you're
to do with
if you're white enough race. And if you're rich enough. Crime does pay, Chris. Yeah, spot on. Tragically, and we need to change that. It's coming up on. It's a little past 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. Harold in Chicago. Hey, Harold, what's on your mind today?
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was calling just to point out some contradictions I hear, especially when you have callers who say that they're, you know, either conservative or Christian, like a gentleman that you had a little while ago. But he immediately went into his support for Donald Trump, who is totally anti-Christian. And then he's talking about things like his taxes, and he and his wife made $1,000 back from their taxes. But what about the $1 trillion deficit that tax bill generated? And how is that espousing Christianity or conservatism?
Right.
And I think it just points to the disconnect that we have in this country and how it's important. I think we have a lot of those people in our lives who kind of espouse a lot of those illogical ideas, but we just have to keep on moving toward progressive ideas.
Yeah, you're right. What I should have said to him is, oh, so you borrowed $1,000 from your grandchildren, and you think that's a good thing?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, yeah
I just think it's funny and wanted to take a minute out to
Got it.
Out on that.
Well, thank you, Harold. Very
thank
well
you.
Said. Thank you very much. I appreciate the call. John in Cambria, California. Am I saying it right, John?
Yep, that's right.
So what's up?
Hey, I just want to keep this short so you can get some other people in here, but I forget who said this, but I think it's relevant to your topic. It goes, when you're privileged, equality feels like oppression.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's exactly what's happening in the white communities. And Donald Trump is selling that message.
So how do we talk to white people about that?
That is a good question.
Without, you know, making them feel victimized or villainized.
I don't know, because I'm white and I'm 57 years old. I don't feel victimized. I mean, I grew up in Los Angeles, pretty diverse area.
Right.
And I don't know. I think it's probably just because to answer your question, I don't know how to talk to someone who grew up.
See, we are seeing, here's what we're looking at, John. You know, over the last 40 years, Reaganomics has basically transferred about $12 trillion out of the pockets, mostly out of the home equity, frankly, and savings account and retirement accounts of largely white middle class America and into the pockets of, you know, a couple hundred thousand people in the top 1% who are now worth billions and billions and billions of dollars. And their corporations and to China. So there's been this massive reduction in the wealth of the white middle class. The white middle class looks around and says, why did this happen? Why is it that we can't take vacations anymore? Why is it that we can't make ends meet? And
Right. You've
got a whole group of people, by and large other white people, but you know, wealthy white people, who come to them and say, oh, well, it's because those brown people are taking your jobs. Or 30 years ago, if we were talking about the male white middle class, which was, you know, 30, 40 years ago, most households were, you know, single-headed household, they would say, oh, it's those women coming into the workplace, and they're the ones who are taking your job. And those are the things, those are the memes that, you know, have just been everywhere, and you can't, you know, there's actually a grain of truth to that, but it's not somebody else being in the workplace with you that is hurting you. What is hurting you is the policies of Reaganism, is the policies of, you know, no longer having a union, no longer having somebody to defend you, no longer having a social safety net. And it's just awful. John, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Larry in Upland, California. Hey, Larry, what's up?
Hi. I know how to address the socialism versus capitalism.
Okay. You got 30
what
seconds.
You do is, okay, what you do is you tell, Democrats need to tell the truth about what's happening with our economy. And that is, in the last 120 years, Democrats have seen roughly 20,000 points added to the Dow. The Republicans, prior to Trump becoming president, saw zero. And actually, the points that Trump has seen only occurred while Obama's policies were in play.
Right.
In other words, Republican policies have given America $0 in capitalism. Democrats have put all of it in there, but they did it by putting socialist systems into our economy.
Yeah, yeah, lifting people out of poverty and, yeah, building an American
middle class. Putting money in poor people's hands.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. Larry, thank you. Spot on. Alrighty, what a day, huh? We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. And in the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It does require all of us, all hands on deck. It requires full participation. So please, get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great afternoon, and keep it up. We got a long way to go here, but it's possible to make all this work. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.